It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is out today. Coming up on Wisconsin Life, we'll meet a button collector and ask you to share your interesting or odd collections. First, today's the anniversary of the passage of the Endangered Species Act in 1973. There have been some environmental successes that were achieved because of the protections that it gives, but analysts also say that in some areas the law hasn't had the hoped-for impact. Peter Alagona is an associate professor in the Environmental Studies and History Departments at the University of California, Santa Barbara. He's the author of the book After the Grizzly, Endangered Species and the Politics of Place in California. Peter, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, Rob. Happy holidays.
Happy holidays to you as well. Well, when we're evaluating the impact of the Endangered Species Act, it seems like people don't always agree on how to measure it. Are we measuring it based on species we kept from going extinct, species we returned to a sustainable population, or species we restored to their original levels? Is there agreement on what success looks like?
That's a great question, Rob. The answer is no, there isn't agreement, and that explains a lot of the debate that surrounds the law today. If you look at the Endangered Species Act today, there have been around 1,600 species listed since its passage, about 42 years ago, actually exactly 42 years ago today. About 700 of these are animals, about 900 plant species. The state with the greatest number is Hawaii, because that's a particular case of a devastated flora and fauna there. But endangered species are listed all over the country. If you look nationwide, only about 1% of the species that have been listed since the act was passed in 1973 have gone extinct. But only about 2% of those that have been listed have recovered to the point where they can be removed from the act and declared no longer endangered. So what this means is it leaves about 97% of the species that have ever been listed still considered endangered today, and that's the source of a lot of the debate that you hear in the news.
Well, the question would be, this has just been 42 years in a process of extinction that might have been going on for a century or maybe centuries. Is this too short a time horizon to think of a success or failure?
Well, that's certainly one of the critiques that many supporters of the Act offer. Many of the species that have been listed over the past four-plus decades now were in a pretty bad way by the time they actually fell under federal protection. And so to recover them could take many years. It could involve complicated changes to management and policy. And even under the best of circumstances, I think that many species that took decades to decline will take decades to recover. On the other hand, however, many people point out that some of the species that have had the most attention and the most resources dedicated to their conservation under the law are still continuing to decline. And so this is a great concern, and it brings up questions about where we should best spend our money and what's the best way to really achieve the goals that have been set out under the ESA that many people, I think, in this country really still value and support today.
Now, I've read elsewhere that you say one concern with the Endangered Species Act is that it was locked into place in 1972 as a federal program with all the bureaucratic details that involves. Since then, we've learned things, but the flexibility to take what we've learned and apply it may not be there. How do you see that playing out?
I think that's really correct. And a lot of folks who are responsible for administering the Act in the Fish and Wildlife Service and in the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration have asked for greater flexibility under the Act to do something that scientists and managers call adaptive management. Basically, what adaptive management means is it means learning by doing. You try something out, you see if it works. If it works, that's great. If it doesn't work, you've learned something and you can move forward with a new strategy. The Endangered Species Act does provide some ability to do that, some ability to do adaptive management, but because of many of the restrictions under the Act, some of those opportunities have been lost or not taken, and so I think that we could do a whole lot better in that way. We also know a lot from a range of scientific studies and studies in the law and history and a variety of other fields over many years that could also be applied to the Act if we could find a way to improve it through amendments. But the proposed amendments over the years have generally, I think, not sought to improve the Act in ways that would make it more effective. Instead, they've tried to water down the Act in ways that would probably make it less effective but make it more streamlined for folks that have problems with it.
We'll get more into that issue in a moment, but the idea of having maybe an experimental population is the fear, maybe the reason we don't do more of that is, okay, we've got this species with limited numbers. We don't want to take any chances. We don't want to experiment and risk losing a part of an already small population.
That's absolutely a part of it, certainly. There is a mechanism under the Endangered Species Act for what's called scientific take. And what that basically means is that you can potentially get a permit to do a project that experiments with a listed species if it's warranted for scientific or conservation purposes and if it doesn't pose a significant threat to the persistence of the species. So this kind of thing is allowed, but as you can imagine, many of the folks who are responsible for administering the act and see themselves as the sort of last backstop for many of these species that are really on the brink of extinction have been fairly unwilling in many cases to do this because they're concerned that any actions could lead to the further decline of these plants and animals.
Talking about the Endangered Species Act with Peter Alagona from the University of California, Santa Barbara. I want to talk about the politics and the disagreements over the act that you referred to a few moments ago, Peter. As I understand it, this act passed the Senate with no votes against it, which is hard to imagine environmental legislation, now passing unanimously in effect. But very soon it became a source of great controversy. Was there something that they did wrong in passing this act that didn't take into account the conflicts that were going to arise?
Well, that's a great story and a really great question as well. You know, laws trying to protect fish and wildlife in this country actually go back many decades, at least to the mid-19th century. The federal government got involved in 1900 with the first federal law on behalf of fish and wildlife, the Lacey Act. And so the Endangered Species Act is really the culmination, in many ways, of three-quarters of a century of congressional federal legislation on behalf of wildlife in the United States. As you said, the Endangered Species Act passed in 1973 by a vote of 390-12 in the House and a 92-0 voice vote in the Senate, and then was signed by Republican President Richard Nixon. Now, I don't think that this was a mistake or a lack of foresight necessarily, but what I do think is at that time, in that context of 1973, there was a tremendous amount of bipartisan support behind the idea of environmental protection and behind the idea of endangered species protection in particular. Just a tremendous amount. It wasn't really until the late 1970s, 5, 6, 7 years later, and early 1980s, when the country began to turn more politically conservative and to turn away from some of that legislative activism of the 1960s and 70s, that the ESA, the Endangered Species Act, became a symbol of these laws of an earlier period, and there was a backlash against it. So the Endangered Species Act was part of a much larger history of legislative activism in the 60s and 70s, and then a sort of backlash against that in the 1980s. What I will say, though, is that throughout the history of endangered species conservation in this country, public opinion polls have consistently shown that despite the often divisive politics, people tend to be broadly behind the idea of preserving endangered species and doing what we can to keep them around, because this is a long-term proposition, not a short one that should be governed by political cycles.
Now, a lot of the conflicts you mentioned seem to involve government restrictions on what people can do with land for personal or economic purposes. Again, I've read elsewhere that you say there are a lot of opportunities for cooperation between landowners, private business landowners, also state agencies for that matter, and federal regulators on the Endangered Species Act. Could we be doing more along those lines? What kind of things could we do?
You know, the idea of trying to enroll and incentivize private landowners in more conservation programs goes back all the way to the 1930s. And one of the primary proponents of that was a Wisconsin native, Aldo Leopold, who in the 1930s wrote that private landowners needed to be more incentivized and more brought into conservation programs in a way that benefited them and also benefited the other species involved. So this idea has been around a long time. We have some very good programs, both under the Endangered Species Act itself and at the state level in many states, but oftentimes these have been underused, And I think it's just a tremendous opportunity to bring more people into the fold and to bring into line interests that are already there. I think that most landowners, farmers, ranchers, and others are greatly concerned about conservation. They want biological diversity, healthy ecosystems. The ones I talk to here in California tell me that all the time. But they're concerned that some of the laws that they see on the books actually get in the way of them doing that. And so how can we make these laws, how can we make the ESA more responsive to their interests and their needs while also bringing them more into the fold of conservation? I think we've got some models out there, but I think we really need to build on them in the future.
Supposing Congress, I guess, takes another look at the Endangered Species Act, do you think that positive changes like that would be the result? Or are you worried about, opening up a Pandora's box and having a lot of revisions that weaken the act overall?
Well, that has certainly been the concern over the past few decades. Many folks who are supportive of the Endangered Species Act have seen attempts to amend the act over the past couple decades as endangering the act itself, not just the species it aims to conserve. And so that's been a political concern of many folks in Washington and elsewhere who want to see this act continue into the future and continue along the lines it's been going, doing good work on behalf of many species. But what I would say is that if you look at history, if you look at American conservation history, there have really been three periods in which most of our laws have been passed to protect species and to protect ecosystems and to protect our environment. The Progressive Era during the late 19th and early 20th centuries, the New Deal era of the 1930s, and then the post-war era of the 1960s and 70s. And so what I often tell folks is that we need to be working to try to figure out better solutions to the problems that endangered species face today so that when the stars align out there in the political world, that we have good ideas and good solutions to real problems that can be put into action, knowing that the political stars will not always be aligned. And they certainly have not been over the past couple decades.
As we wrap up, Peter, speaking of that history, you're in kind of a unique position as someone who studies environmental sciences and history. Do we pay enough attention to our history of conservation and endangered species protection in the U.S.? Is there a lot more we could learn from what we've been doing over the last century plus?
Yes.
All right. That's a good place.
Actually, if I could take 1 second, Rob,
sure.
I would just say absolutely yes, yes, yes. We have a tremendous amount to learn from the mistakes we've made, from the success stories that we do have, and there are some conservation success stories out there that we can point to. There will be more in the coming years, and so telling those stories in a way that's compelling, that can be empowering to people to understand how we can build on these success stories, I think is incredibly important. I will also say, though, that the future of conservation may look very different from the past. And what I mean by that is that we're encountering new challenges today and in the future that will require really wholly new ways of thinking about conservation. These include climate change, for example, we all know about that, but also the advent of synthetic biology, which gives us the opportunity, or perhaps the challenge, I would say, of figuring out how to use techniques that allow us to alter organisms in ways that could fundamentally change what we think of as being natural, but might also give us new opportunities to conserve species that we value and that we always have. So history is a tremendous guide. It can give us wisdom, can give us a sense of how we've gotten to where we're at, but we also need a lot of good conservation, a lot of good science, and a lot of good, talented folks on the ground to figure out how to address these other problems in the future.
Peter, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob.
That's Peter Alagona. He's Associate Professor in the Environmental Studies and History Departments at the University of California, Santa Barbara. He's the author of the book After the Grizzly, Endangered Species and the Politics of Place in California. He joins us to talk about the history and future of the Endangered Species Act. It was signed into law on this day in 1973. Nearly everyone collects something. We want to hear from you in just a couple of minutes. You can call in now. Do you collect something? Do you have a collection? What is it? Something fairly normal, coins, stamps, say, or something a little further off the beaten path. Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. For Middleton's Gary Brockman, that collection is buttons. He tells us in this episode of Wisconsin Life what he loves about these everyday fasteners and the deep human history that can be read on their faces.
I've collected a lot of things across my life, but I can't think of another type of object that pulls together the loose threads of sociology and art history and material science and technology in such a complete way as buttons do. Early 90s, I was working in publishing in New York, and long story short, I needed some buttons for a workshop we were going to do with science teachers, and did the workshop. There happened to be two people who were button collectors in that group of science teachers, and once the buttons went out on the table, the science portion of the workshop was over for them. I just sidled around to where they were owing and awing over them and asked them what was going on, and they told me they were button collectors and these were really wonderful buttons, and I asked them if they would stay around after the workshop ended and just tell me about them, and they did, and I was hooked from that point on. There is, of course, the Midwestern shell button industry. Most of the shell buttons that came out of Wisconsin waters were utilitarian. They were fairly plain. They might have a little bit of decorative carving. But there were also outfits that would cut blanks, just cut discs from the shells, and then ship them to Europe for finishing, for cameo carving and other modes of tooling that would produce very deluxe buttons. So in some cases, the utilitarian buttons went directly to market from Wisconsin. In other cases, Wisconsin was one link in a supply chain that included Europe. Button collecting has had a couple of different iterations. It was very popular during the Victorian era. As an organized hobby in the United States, it really dates back to the late 1930s. The publisher of Hobbies Magazine in Chicago was instrumental in putting together a group of people who wanted to form a national button society, which still exists and which every few years has its national convention here in Wisconsin. I think buttons matter in the way that any material from any culture at any point in history matters. They're windows into our past. You know, there's that really tired old saying, those who forget their history are condemned to repeat it. And this is just one more avenue into human history, into cultural history, into technological history. You've got it all right here. You can see the development of artistic styles. You can see the development of manufacturing techniques. Everything is connected to everything else.
Gary Brockman's a button collector and dealer. Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. It's a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more online at wisconsinlife.org. Well, that's Gary's button collection. Now it's your turn. What do you collect? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Straight to our callers now. We've got Tom on the line in Milwaukee. Tom, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. Really love your show. I collect newspapers. There's a few people that do that, but I'm finding not too many. For various reasons, newspapers are very, very hard to preserve, number one. And I guess some people just don't have an interest in it, but I'm kind of a historian, so that's my angle. And I've got newspapers that go back way before World War II.
What's the is there a crown jewel, Tom, a favorite or most interesting newspaper you've collected?
Well, I've got a couple that I think are kind of interesting. I've got the New York newspaper, and as far as I know, it's the only newspaper in the country where that photo ever appeared. But when John Lennon was assassinated, there was a photo that was taken of Mark David Chapman, I think his name was, getting his album autographed by John Lennon.
Wow.
Just a couple hours before it happened.
Tom.
And so I've got that newspaper from New York.
That's really interesting. Tom, thank you so much for sharing your newspaper collection. That's quite a one to have, too. We'll go next to Jim with us in Rice Lake. Jim, hi.
How are you?
Good. What do you collect, Jim?
I collect the, they're called N-blocks, and they're what goes into an M1 rifle, M1 Garand rifle. Which I have a collection of anyways, but there are some that were made before excuse me, during World War II and post-World War II, and the ones I collect were made during World War II, and each manufacturer has a their own stamp that they put on them, so you can tell by looking at the stamp who made them and what era they were from.
And what? Why did you start collecting these end blocks from these rifles?
It's just something that I can do and collect. You get some of these and some of those, and I have a couple that I've never seen, but I know they're out there. It's something that goes with the rifle, so I have some World War II rifles that are actually, the serial number was dated during World War II, so if I ever decide to depart with them, I can throw in a World War II end blocks to go with them.
Fantastic. Thanks a lot, Jim. Quick call from Greg with us in Cottage Grove. Greg, hi.
Hi.
What do you collect, Greg?
I collect baskets because I feel that they're the oldest form of carryalls dating way back to the Ojibwas and the Ho-Chunks, which were Winnebagos.
Mm-hmm.
One of my backpacks is actually a woven basket.
That's fantastic. Thank you. You can keep sharing your collections on the Central Time Facebook page. You're listening to the Ideas Network. For many decades, Wisconsin's forests were monitored by people staffing fire towers. Using low-tech tools, they were the key to detecting forest fires before they could spread. But like in a lot of areas of life today, high-tech options are now available that might do a better job for cheaper. Plus, some of those towers have been deemed dangerous. The needed repairs would be expensive. As a result, Wisconsin's fire towers will no longer be staffed starting next year. Joining us now to talk about how Wisconsin's forest will be monitored is Trent Marty. He's director of the Bureau of Forest Protection for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Trent, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Happy to be here.
Well, before we get to the future of fire detection, let's look at the past a little bit. How big a role had these fire towers played in the past?
The fire towers have been critical for the success of our forest fire management program here in Wisconsin. Since when they were first put on the landscape in the 30s, 40s, and through the 50s and that, they were one of our primary means of fire detection, especially in the north. It was very lightly populated back in the 30s and 40s and things in that regards. For us to be able to spot a fire early, to get resources to that fire, was critical for our success.
Well, talk about, paint us a picture of what this job might be like for part-time workers seasonally, I think, going up during the times of highest risk. How far up are they going? What are they looking at? What's the vista there?
Well, most of the towers are located, of course, on the higher ground in the state of Wisconsin. Most of our towers are between 80 and 100 feet tall from the ground level. They generally have a sight picture, a 360-degree radius, so somewhere between 12 and 15 miles. Some can see a little farther than that. The smoke is large in that regard. So that's generally the primary area they're looking at. They're above the canopies, so, I mean, it's quite a vista from any of the fire towers.
And a real simple procedure, I guess, they see smoke and they phone it in? Were these rigged with phone lines in the early days, or do they have to use a wireless radio of some sort?
Actually, in the early days, they were connected by phone lines, and the DNR actually had the second largest phone company in the state of Wisconsin.
No kidding.
At one point in time, in the 30s and 40s. Since that, we've transitioned over to portable radios and things, the towers and things, so use the radio communication system here in the state of Wisconsin to report the smokes.
How many towers are we talking about at their peak and now as they're winding down?
At one time in Wisconsin, we had 119 towers that functioned at the high point, which probably would have been in the mid-50s. Right now, we have 72 towers that are operational in the state of Wisconsin, and we staffed 60 of those towers last spring.
I heard the number 72 originally and thought, oh, that's one per county, but obviously they're not one per county. They're where they're needed in the forested areas of the state.
Correct. Our towers are really heavily concentrated in central Wisconsin in the sand area there, from Wisconsin Rapids over to Black River Falls, and then across the northern third of the state, where the heavily forested areas of the state are at.
Talking to Trent Marty, Director of the Bureau of Forest Protection for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, talking about these fire lookout towers that are now being phased out here in Wisconsin. We've talked about the history some, Trent. Now, what has led us to this point today where we think we don't need these anymore, we're going to move on?
Well, it's really not a discussion about the effectiveness of fire towers. It really comes down to, of course, they've been on the landscape since the 30s and 40s, exposed to the elements here in Wisconsin for all this period of time. And, you know, it's getting to the point in time where they need to be replaced on the landscape where we're going to continue to use them. And as we looked at replacing them, each of those towers was going to be about $300,000 a piece in today's dollars to replace. And you do the math, 72 times 300,000, and it comes out around $24 million. And in regards to light of needs within the program, we just couldn't justify that type of investment in our fire towers here going forward. 90% of our fires these days are reported by the public with cell phones or by landlines. So we've decided not to make that investment in fire towers going forward. Rely on citizen reporting. Take the dollars that we used to have for staffing towers, doing the maintenance of the towers, and utilize that to provide additional aerial detection on those very high fire danger days in the spring.
Right, as I understand it, it used to be that a lot of these forests we're talking about were very remote, isolated, nobody living there, and if somebody happened to be hiking there, they didn't have cell phones back in the day because there were no cell phones, or when there were, there wasn't reception. That's less true now.
It is. The amount of people in northern Wisconsin has increased dramatically. The number of people in northern Wisconsin, either living, visiting, having a second home there, that have cell phones, access to that for whether it's a forest fire or other type of emergency, has increased dramatically. And we think that we can still serve the needs of the state of Wisconsin and provide the fire protection we need by increasing our aerial detection and relying on the public to report fires.
So for the people who did this job, how, as I understand, they were part-time and seasonal, so how much of any given year might they be up in the actual tower?
On average, our towers were staffed about 17 days a year. Over the last 4 or 5 years. So only on those very high fire danger days did we staff towers. So
what actually happens to, the 72 towers themselves?
Well, each of those 72 towers is probably going to be a unique situation to work through. A lot of the towers are on public lands, state, county, or federal lands, so they'll have one path to work through. But actually, a majority of our towers are on private lands where we have easements with the landowners that were developed in the 30s, 40s, 50s. And we'll have to work with the underlying landowner to meet what their needs are, what their wishes are and stuff for their land and for the tower going forward in the future. You know, we've had some discussions in regards to trying to repurpose the towers for increasing broadband across northern Wisconsin. You know, that's something we're working with some communities up there to try and help repurchase the tower for the communities and things in that regard. So each tower, I think, you know, we'll work through it on an individual case basis and things like that. But there'll be a majority of different outcomes. Some towers will probably be removed from the landscape. Some will remain on the landscape, possibly as historical sites. Who knows?
I wanted to get into that, but before we get to the history idea, is there any talk of, I mean, it'd be pretty cool, I would think, to go up in one of these and have a look. Is there any thought or effort to taking some of these and making them accessible to the public?
Well, again, one of the reasons that we're actually closing these towers is because of the safety concerns and the structural integrity of the towers and stuff. We don't feel it's safe for our personnel to be in them, so we really don't want to encourage the public to be climbing the towers or even in that regards.
Fair enough. Well, this is, you mentioned the historical aspect. These are a part of our state's history. Is there any eye toward historical preservation of a couple of them just to have a monument to the way we used to track our forests?
That's actually something we're going to start looking at here in January going forward. Each of our towers that we have will be inspecting from a historical perspective. And I know there is a couple towers already right now that are in the process of being preserved, one in the town of Phelps. And then there's also another one designated on a historical landmark in the county of Marinette. So there will probably be several towers maintained here in the state of Wisconsin from that historical perspective.
I wonder, you're looking for public participation in this. Obviously, wildfires are not really our worry right now today. But as the season comes in, who should the public call? They see a fire, is it they just call 911, or is there an agency that they should call to alert them to signs of a possible forest fire?
Nope, with any type of emergency, whether it's a forest fire or anything else, we want you to dial 911 right away, and they're used to handling it and dispatching the appropriate resources, whether it's a forest fire, or structure fire, or any other type of emergency house. So, yep, if you see smoke, smell smoke, dial 911, and they can bring their appropriate resources, whether it's the Department of Natural Resources or the local fire department to the scene.
So as this change comes into effect in 2016, how do you measure success? How do you know if things are working okay without these towers having people in them?
We have some measures of success. We rely on rapid initial attack for measuring our success. So our measure of success is that each fire that's reported is staffed within 30 minutes of reporting.
All right, Trent, thanks a lot for joining us today.
I appreciate it.
That's Trent Marty. He's director of the Bureau of Forest Protection for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. He joins us to talk about the end of an era. Starting in 2016, Wisconsin's staffed fire towers will be replaced with public observation, aerial observation, and other high-tech methods. You may be looking forward to ringing in the new year, and if you're having friends over to celebrate, you might be looking for some festive beverages to serve. Wisconsin has a reputation for making and enjoying beer, increasingly good wine, but there are also some fun cocktails for the holiday season that make use of Wisconsin products. You can join in, by the way, at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite cocktail with or without alcohol that you'll be serving on New Year's Eve? And have you put a Wisconsin twist on it using one of the growing number of products distilled here in the state? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page where you'll find some recipes. Allison Sherwood is an interactive lifestyle producer for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She recently wrote a piece on cocktails with the Wisconsin twist. Allison, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it seems like there's a boom. Cocktails are getting more popular, and we're seeing more and more liquors distilled here in the state. What do you think is it about mixed drinks in particular that are getting people into them, maybe back into them where they didn't used to be?
Yeah, I think there's been a huge push towards craft everything these days, making small batch food, drink, and cocktails kind of go along right with that. The Wisconsin Distillers Guild now has 19 distilleries in it. Back in 2006, Great Lakes Distillery in Milwaukee was the first distillery to open in Wisconsin since Prohibition. So there's definitely been a boom in new craft distilleries opening, and they're very collaborative, working with other beverage producers here. So it's really a fun way to try different products made here.
And so you went out and surveyed different people in the industry to try to get some cocktails. First of all, who did you reach out to get some ideas for these holiday cocktails with a Wisconsin twist?
So I got some cocktails from Twisted Path Distillery in Milwaukee, Wisco Pop, which is actually a craft soda company. They use all natural ingredients. They're sweetened with honey. They collaborate with some other Death's Door spirits and some other distilleries to create some cocktails. Top Note Tonics is a new craft tonic concentrate maker here in Milwaukee, and they had a great punch recipe. And then also Central Standard Distillery in Milwaukee and Bitter Cube. There's a lot of great recipes and mixologists that are coming up with recipes that combine a lot of these different local companies and making great Wisconsin drinks.
And Allison, as I understand it, you made a wise editorial decision and didn't sample all of these cocktails in the writing of this. Otherwise, you never would hit your deadline, I imagine.
Yeah, that would have made it a little tough.
Well, let's get into some of the recipes that we heard about. A lot of cocktails, you know, a liquor of some sort, a mixer, but mixology, as they call it, gets really fancy. Here's one of the more basic cocktails you feature, though, Milwaukee Mule. I've heard of a Moscow Mule, a favorite for a lot of people. What went into the Milwaukee Mule?
So the Milwaukee Mule is very simple. It's just vodka, Sprecher ginger ale, and fresh lime juice. And that is a really quick and easy, you can use a vodka from a local distillery, use the local Sprecher ginger ale, and you'll have a nice, refreshing, and simple drink.
And the benefit there is if you're doing something instead of champagne, you with this cocktail, at least you still get some of the bubbles.
Exactly.
And what the Great Lakes Distillery was one that that gave this to you, right?
Yes. Yep.
Another variation on an old favorite, the now I've heard of a dark and stormy. You've got the Wisco White and Stormy. What's that?
Yeah, that's another really simple, straightforward cocktail. It's from Wisco Pop, the craft soda company that I mentioned. And that uses rum from Old Sugar Distillery in Madison and then ginger soda and a wedge of lime.
We're talking to Allison Sherwood from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about New Year's Eve cocktails. She surveyed different people in the industry, got ideas for cocktails for New Year's Eve that use different Wisconsin products. So soda in some cases, alcohol distilled here in the state in others, sometimes both. You can join in, by the way, at 800-642-1234. Do you have a New Year's Eve beverage tradition? Do you go with the straightforward champagne, some kind of bubbly alcoholic champagne, or maybe just a sparkling cider? That was a big family one, or sparkling grape juice. Call in with your favorite cocktail that you're planning to serve New Year's Eve, or maybe a Wisconsin product that will be at your table in your New Year's Eve celebration. The number is 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you could post on the Central Time Facebook page where you could find Allison's article. Get some recipes that might inspire some ideas of your own. Well, Allison, we've kept it pretty simple so far. I think we'll start adding more ingredients. The punch bowl comes out sometimes at a celebration like this. Punch bowl is nice because you don't have to keep mixing all night. You wrote about the Top Note Tonic Holiday Punch. So what are what are the Wisconsin ingredients in that one?
So this one uses Top Note Tonic's bitter orange tonic and their ginger beer. And then you've also got Great Lakes Distillery gin and Bitter Cube orange bitters. So we've got several local products in this one. And yes, punch is always great for parties, makes things really easy. You can mix it up ahead of time. This one, this recipe, a great tip that I learned from this, for punch, it's nice to make a giant ice cube to put in the middle instead of having a bunch of ice that's going to melt. So just to do that, you would just fill a medium-sized bowl or a huge ice cube mold with water, and you can even layer in some orange slices, cinnamon sticks, other herbs or spices in there to add some flavor and just make it look really pretty.
Well, that sounds cool. So that'll just slowly melt all night instead of all the little ice cubes melting really fast and watering things down.
Keep it cold without getting too diluted.
Well, before we get back to some of the specialty cocktails you collected, I want to ask, do you have a favorite a mixed drink that you might serve at a gathering of this sort or hope someone else serves?
Well, champagne is always classic for New Year's Eve. So I'm having a few people over on New Year's Eve, and I plan to do something with champagne. You can keep it really simple and just add a flavored simple syrup to a champagne flute and then fill it with champagne and maybe garnish it with berries or herbs. Right this time of year, I think rosemary or sage look really pretty on a glass.
And champagne, people mix it with different liqueurs sometimes, too. Like there's a champagne and cassis, I think, is one that I've encountered in the past. I thought worked really well, kind of refreshing, mixes up the champagne if you're not into the pure champagne taste. Any ideas for mixes like that?
Well, a really classic champagne cocktail is a cube of sugar, a sugar cube in the bottom of the glass. Then you put some bitters on it and then fill it with champagne. And that kind of adds a little bit of sweetness, but then you also have the bitter taste from the bitters. And I think that's kind of a what you're looking for in any good cocktail is a balance between the different flavors. You want sweet, sour, bitter. So whenever you're coming up with a drink, try to keep those flavors in mind. And then as you taste it, if it's something's a little off, think about that when you're trying to add different elements.
We had an email from Matt and DePere who told us about a distillery called Yerlo. It's a Hmong distillery in Door County, and they make an alcohol from jasmine rice. I guess the owner's family, Matt says, has been cultivating their own yeast for generations, and he says they make great old fashions. And I noticed, Allison, nobody gave you an old fashioned recipe, but I guess the brandy old fashioned sweet is such a Wisconsin twist to begin with. You don't need to Wisconsin it up at all.
Yeah, that would definitely be a good classic Wisconsin cocktail to have on your menu.
A lot of muddling, though. So you have to prepare yourself for some work if you're serving those. Well, right. Around the holidays, we've got snow outside. Nice to have a decadent option. And one called the Winter Wonderland Cocktail you gathered. Sounds pretty good. Vodka made in Wisconsin, and there's Wisconsin roasted coffee in this one, too.
Yeah, this is a good example of how different companies will collaborate together. So Central Standard Craft Distillery worked with Anodyne Coffee Roasting in Milwaukee to make this coffee vodka, which is brand new. And they soak the vodka in the coffee beans. And now I guess they're actually even looking to sell those vodka-soaked beans that are left over to a chocolate maker to make some sort of other concoction from it. So different kind of threefold collaboration there. But this Winter Wonderland cocktail sounds delicious. It's got coffee vodka, creme de menthe, Irish cream, and then you garnish it with a mint leaf and top it off with a little bit of cinnamon.
So that sounds good, and the idea of the coffee vodka I get. I don't know if I want to try chocolate with coffee beans soaked in vodka. Does that sound good to you?
That sounds good to me.
You'd go for it.
I don't know. I'd try it.
Let's wrap up with a good one to wrap up with. It's called the Holiday Goodbye Cocktail. Who gave that one to you?
This comes from Brian Sammons, who's the founder and distiller of Twisted Path Distillery in Milwaukee. And this drink is just beautiful. It's bright red. It's garnished with a sage leaf, so it has this great holiday look to it. It uses Twisted Path white rum, fresh lime juice, simple syrup, Bitter Cubes blackstrap bitters, and then it's also got some blackberries and seltzer water in it. And he said the blackberry lends a slightly tart note reminiscent of berry pie, while sage adds a subtle, warm, savory note. So it's kind of mirroring the flavors that we're going to have, we had on our Christmas table, or the flavors that we like to eat around this time of year, mirroring those in a drink.
Now, of the craft cocktails you gathered, this one sounds like the craftiest, the most ingredients and the most delicate proportions probably. It sounds like this would be the hardest one to make of the bunch.
Yeah, this one you might want to make if it's just, you know, you and your loved one at home for New Year's. It might be harder to make for a crowd, but it would be impressive. It's very pretty.
All right. Well, Allison, before we let you go, you said you're going to be serving some champagne. What are your food plans on New Year's Eve?
Just appetizers and some sort of cheesecake, I think, for dessert.
That's a great. I'm a big fan of just a spread of appetizers on New Year's Eve. Don't know what they're going to be yet. Just a nuclear family this time around for me, though. Allison, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Allison Sherwood with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Her piece that we've been talking about, it's called Holiday Cocktails with a Wisconsin Twist, is linked on the Central Time Facebook page.